Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in the American West, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ryan Driscoll-Tate, and our guest today is Aaron Goins. Aaron is an associate professor of history at St. Martin's University in Washington and the author of a new book called The Port of Missing Men, about capitalism and labor and violence in the Pacific Northwest. The book is out now through the University of Washington Press, just came out at the end of 2020. Aaron, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Ryan. Really good to be here.
So, Aaron, before we get started, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. That's quite the question. So I'm a Pacific Northwesterner. I lived most of my life in the Pacific Northwest with a couple of stretches in Canada and in Europe. And right now I live in Tacoma with my wife and our dog and our kitties. So I'm a historian, mostly interested in labor, social, and immigration history. I work at a small school near the state capital of Olympia, Washington. It's called St. Martin's University. I teach all kinds of things there. I did a lot of my research and writing on the book we're going to talk about and some other projects during my two stretches in Finland, 2014, 2015 on a Fulbright, and then 2017 to 2019 when I was at the University of Tampere. So thinking about my life and some significant turning points, I guess. So I grew up in Aberdeen, an old lumber town in Grays Harbor County, one of Washington's coastal areas, and the rainiest part of the continental United States. If you've ever heard of Aberdeen, it's probably because of Nirvana, which came from the city. Or you've driven through on the way to the Olympic Peninsula or Washington's beaches. Aberdeen's also the setting for this book, and it has a really rich, dramatic working class history. Like so many Pacific Coast cities, Aberdeen is very hilly, and the area's socioeconomic relations really closely mirror its elevation. I grew up there in the 80s and 90s in very much a working class family, and we lived at the bottom of the hill. Back then, there were still a lot of rich families with houses, often old mansions on the hill. And I'm being quite serious now. We're recording this in November. And there's a lot of rain going on outside my house. But we would get so much rain, usually three times as much as Seattle, that garbage from up the hill would run down into our front yard. Sort of an obvious illustration about how class works in the U.S. So this was a very highly unionized and very democratic area. It was the only county in Washington state that went for the Democrats in every presidential election between the Depression and Donald Trump, sort of mirroring the large parts of the Midwest as it switched from blue to red in 2016. And as so much of this region's lumber economy is now shut down, leaving shuttered mills behind, I've sometimes referred to the area and surrounding counties as the Northwest's Rust Belt. But I got through high school in the late 90s, and community college was still really affordable. So I went to Grace Harbor College, got my AAA, then along the way, bachelor's and master's. Along the way, I picked up, like so many people, Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, which really changed things. It opened my eyes to this history of conflict, history of empire, of oppression, and those on the bottom of society coming together to collectively challenge those in power. There was even a couple sentences about my hometown, really kind of surprising to this always wet, always gray area that always seemed so boring to me, and it turned it into a dynamic center of historic change and conflict for me. So about that same time in 2001, the pulp mill where my dad worked and where I had worked went on strike. The workers went on strike. And I spent several nights on picket lines. We did roving pickets to a hotel where scabs were staying. And it was just quite the experience talking to blue-collar workers overnight, hearing about on-the-job deaths, hearing stories of injured and killed workers. Not long after that, I went to Canada to Simon Fraser to do my PhD. I wanted to work with Mark Lear, who's written some brilliant books on labor and anarchist history. He's also really funny and kind, easy person to work with. So I burned through a few dissertation topics. I wanted to write a transnational history of the radical union, the industrial workers of the world, often called the Wobblies, before settling on my dissertation, which was a labor and community study of Grace Harbor, this area that I've been talking about, with a heavy focus on employer solidarity, working class solidarity, and conflict.
So, Aaron, is this how you came to write about Billy Gould, right? This is really the inspiration then behind it.
Yeah. So along the way, I also spent about a year, probably why the dissertation took me so long, looking into the life of this guy who I wrote this book about, Billy Gould. And what I wanted to do in this book, the inspiration behind it was I really figured that if lucky, a historian gets to write a couple books in their lives, maybe three. But I wanted to write a labor and community history of Pacific Northwest lumber. There's so many of these books about mining communities in the Mountain West that are just so influential, whether it's Betsy Jamison's book, All That Glitters. But there's, I don't know, at least a dozen of those. And there's nothing really remotely similar about lumber and labor, community-based labor studies. And the lumber industry was, in the first half of the 20th century, the largest industry in the area by far in the Northwest. But in writing this book, I also wanted to write something that would perhaps lure a lot of people into reading this labor history. And so I set out researching this very, at least regionally, well-known guy named Billy Gould, who's a community and union activist in the early 20th century. He's also one of the most famous people in the history of Washington's Olympic Peninsula. But as you can probably guess, he's not famous for his union activism. He's famous because he's known for his dastardly deeds as one of America's worst serial killers. If anyone hasn't, just from the title of this podcast, you might Google him. And there's just endless accounts written by journalists and true crime buffs. I mean, there's dozens, if not hundreds. In Aberdeen, my hometown, there's a bar and grill called Billy's, named for Gould. And it's actually a pretty good place if you are on your way through town. But the story always seemed a bit ridiculous to me. as I'm sure we'll get into more, it really, the story of Gould really downplayed his life, his work, his activism, and it completely removed social class. And like so many popular books written about sailors, he was a sailor, a migratory worker. So many of the studies seemed rather condescending toward working people, often punching downward, portraying working class people as unintelligent, as violent, as failures who had to resort to violence and lived lives of vice here in this so-called land of opportunity.
So Aaron, you know, Billy Gould had this popular reputation before you wrote this book. What was it? And I mean, I'm wondering about how public historians and scholars understood his legacy and how people wrote about him before your book.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, that's a good question. So no, actually no scholars have ever mentioned Gould. No academic histories have brought him up, but many of the most famous Northwest journalists, Murray Morgan, Stuart Holbrook, and others have written about him. And he is quite famous in the region. Like I said, dozens, if not hundreds, of pieces written about him. All of these stories focus on what I call the myth of the Gould of Grays Harbor. These stories that Gould was a serial killer, that he spent his entire life moving from town to town, seeking out new victims and always staying one step ahead of the police, that he used his position as a union agent in the Sailors Union of the Pacific to terrorize the waterfront. I believe that's a direct quote from one of the pieces written about him. But what I found, so I set out to write this book in part to talk about Gould as potentially a criminal, but also to use him as a lens into the wider social and labor history of the region. But what I found was so interesting and dramatically different from what the previous stories had told. Along the way, I did on and off research on Gould for almost 20 years. It seemed clear that not only were the stories written about Gould mostly free of context, they were also based on lies, exaggerations, and rumors spread by Gould's enemies. That this story of Gould, the serial killer, emerged in the minds of his enemies among the employing class and among conservative anti-labor journalists in early 1910, after years of an investigation led by labor spies, really investigation to remove him from office. That, to be clear, what I found was something very different, and I think more interesting, was that Gould was certainly not a serial killer, but instead a devoted labor activist who spent his life working on behalf of people he called comrades.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, could you also tell us then a little bit about his early life before and after he arrives in Aberdeen?
Right. As one could probably expect, because we are talking here about a person who spent their lives in the working class, we don't know that much about his early life. He's somewhat anonymous. So what we're left with are fragments of his life, really points to the difficulties of writing biographies of the majority of people. So he grew up in Germany, and he moved to the United States at some point in the late 19th century. And he was a migratory laborer. He spent decades working between jobs, of course, as a sailor, as a merchant seaman, but also which is what he was doing at the time of the 1910 census. He then moved to Alaska for a short time, again, working as a laborer in mining and in construction. He did that before he moved to Aberdeen in 1902-1903, eventually settling in Aberdeen and becoming the union agent for the Sailors Union of the Pacific. And this life that he lived, I'm so glad that you asked about it, because I think when most people think about industrial America and industrializing America, we tend to think with good reason about factories and about mines. But the lives of sailors, working class seamen, was just a life of brutality. And so much of the book that I've written here talks about these brutal lives of merchant seamen, and also the people he lived around in Aberdeen, mostly lumber and lumber workers and longshoremen. These were workers who were injured and killed at a horrific rate on the job in Aberdeen, in Gray's Harbor, and in other port cities. The sailors, like Gould too, were they were migratory workers. They were essentially homeless. They lived without permanent homes. When they arrived in port cities, they slept aboard ships or in shacks or in boarding houses. Sailors were also fairly unusual because, according to the law of the land, they were not actually included in laws outlawing indentured servitude. And in fact, if a sailor signed on to work, he was not able to leave the ship. He could be imprisoned, and was so often imprisoned if he deserted ship. In the late 19th century, the Sailors Union, around the time Gould joined the union, wrote this piece of a pamphlet called The Red Record that really detailed the horrific acts of violence committed against sailors. And Gould, within the union, and as a union activist and union agent, is very much responsible for representing workers, when these sailors, when they get to when they get into port, and also making sure that the most violent captains, the most violent, criminally violent owners, didn't get sailors on their ships. He would refuse workers to go on to these so-called hell ships, where captains and mates terrorized workers.
So this is where the 1906 maritime strike comes in, right? Could you explain to us briefly about that, how that changes Gould and the region more broadly?
Right. So the 1906 maritime strike is really a key turning point in Gould's life, but also in the history of Pacific Coast labor and labor relations. But Gould settles into Aberdeen life by 1903, and he becomes the elected agent for the Aberdeen Sailors Union of the Pacific. And that's an important point that I make in this book, is that union agents were elected by the entire union membership. So Gould clearly had a reputation within the Sailors Union for his activism, because several thousand men, working class men, belonged to the union, and they chose him as their representative for this somewhat distant outpost in Aberdeen, long far away from headquarters in San Francisco. But within, he does settle in Aberdeen and in Gray's Harbor as the area is really becoming an important lumber hub and an important lumber port. In fact, by 1906, the towns of Aberdeen and its neighboring town of Hoquiam, the port of Grays Harbor is shipping out the most lumber of any port in the world. And this is also a time when the cities are rapidly growing from just barely villages to some of the largest cities in Washington state by 1910. And all a huge percentage of the workers in the area are unionizing. And Gould is at the head of this union movement. In fact, although it's possible that Seattle had a denser and King County, where Seattle is located, had a denser, more densely unionized working class. Many officials in the Washington State Labor Federation suggested that Grays Harbor was the most heavily unionized. And these workers, 1,000, 2,000 workers, again and again, elect Gould as the head, as first the vice president again of their local labor movement. He becomes very active in state labor politics. And he, in this role, he doesn't just collect a paycheck and sit and get lazy in his office. Instead, he serves as a walking delegate, making sure that conditions on ship, aboard ship, are up to snuff. He serves as a translator, as a German immigrant. He could represent the mostly immigrant, Northern European immigrant sailors in the Union. He represented sailors in court. He helped the homeless sailors build shacks where they stayed when they were in town. He physically fought strikebreakers and carried a gun to intimidate violent bosses, powerful bosses who had so much power. He also asked the city councils of Aberdeen and Hoquiam to install streetlights so fewer people would fall in and die in the cities. He asked authorities to regulate saloons, knowing full well that was where so many working class people were in the first place getting drunk and falling into the water and drowning or being taken advantage of, drugged and killed. He spent so much time writing letters to the editor to advocate for workers. And the 1906 maritime strike, we really see the tension between workers and employers boiling up into this massive coastwide strike between sailors and members of organized capital, the lumbermen and the shippers who had their employer's organization to fight labor. So the strike grew out of the really pretty famous San Francisco earthquake and fire that leveled the city. Probably unsurprisingly, the people in the Bay Area needed Northwest wood to rebuild. And so they had a heavy demand for Northwest wood that was being met in part by Northwest mills, Northwest logging camps. And so with the price of lumber sky high in 1906, lumbermen and shippers were just making remarkable profits, raking in the profits. The sailors' union demanded small wage increases and were refused. They were refused by captains and owners and the lumbermen who controlled so much of the trade. So as the strike, so the sailors' union declares strike. In some places, the longshoremen join the sailors. Grays Harbor was one of several real centers of the strike, and in Aberdeen, the municipal government does what so often happens during strikes. They swear in special police. They import strikebreakers who are armed and attacking, even killing strikers during the strike. They also use injunctions and arrests. against the strikers. And most of the local newspapers just are just brutal in their attacks on workers and strikers. But especially Billy Gould, who is the head of the labor movement, who is the head of the Sailors Union, is very much active in leading organized labor, often in armed picket lines, as well as raids on non-union ships. They maintain, he also exchanges taunts and gunfire with some of the bosses in the local area. And I think I need to step back for a second, because that's just so unusual. It's so common in labor history for workers, union workers, to fight strike breakers, to fight scabs and even police sometimes. But here was Billy Gould leading this union movement and refusing to back down in the face of the bosses who had so much power over the press, over local government and the like. You can imagine what the response of the conservative press that referred to him as a pirate, as a thug, for his use of quite militant tactics to keep the waterfront free from scabs and to keep it a unionized waterfront so that workers would have labor protections.
Right. You know, Aaron, you write in the book about this really transformative moment in Gould's life right after the strike. In a chapter you're calling Struggling or Struggle for Respectability, you know, he begins to identify as a clerk and a cigar merchant at certain points. What's causing that change?
Right. That might be my favorite chapter of the book. That's called Struggling for Respectability or something like that. So Gould's life undergoes this dramatic shift, and I employ the notion of working class respectability. During his years in Aberdeen, in Grays Harbor, his life undergoes some pretty dramatic changes from the rough life of a sailor living aboard ship or in a shack, facing dangers aboard ship and being really occasionally injured or even tortured at the hands of captains and mates, and spending a good deal of time in saloons. Gould is often said to have had a tremendous appetite for drinking early in his life on the harbor. But by 1903, 1904, Gould is settling into a permanent life in Aberdeen. He has an office job. He's a so-called white-collar sailor, and he's become a union official, a labor bureaucrat. His job duties are dramatically different from those of a sailor aboard ship. He also is able to save enough money to start a cigar stand, to co-own a cigar stand, and he begins to join these fraternities like the Foresters and the Eagles, where some skilled workers as well as middle-class people belong. He's also a resident of this area, which means he can vote. Very unusual for sailors to vote in 1905, 1906, he's one of five or six sailors who were registered to vote in Aberdeen. Compare this with small businessmen who all could vote, almost all of them. And in 1905, he marries a working class woman named Bessie Hager, and she purchases and runs a rooming house that marketed to, quote, gentlemen along the rivers. She and Billy both live there for several years. They have permanent renters, including prominent local saloon owners. He's not really living the life of a rough migratory worker any longer. Instead, he's moving in increasingly respectable circles. And this is also when Aberdeen's population is a decade when it goes from about 3,000 to 14,000. And so he's there becoming established when many other people are, and he's settling into this life of respectability, spending a lot of time in fraternal activities and the like. The problem, though, was that he was a worker and that he was a militant union leader. He had no intention of selling out his co-workers. He had no intention of simply collecting a salary and sitting in his office and doing nothing. He knew full well the way that captains and other employers treated sailors. Again, the men he called comrades in speeches and in writing. And he broke the law to defend their interests. He raided ships to make sure that non-unionists wouldn't break picket lines. He'd spent time in court. He spent time behind bars. And for his militant defense of workers, he becomes an absolute hero in the labor movement. They elect him again to be president of the local labor council. He founds this almost quasi-industrial union called the Waterfront Federation that is an organization of all the militant workers who work along the waterfront, including the longshoremen, the shingle weavers. But he's also enemy number one to local bosses. He is the only person who shuts down their real money-making machine in the first decade of the 20th century. He shuts down the port and he wins the strike by resorting to militancy. And for that, local newspapers, editors who all belong to the Chamber of Commerce, where so much employer activity takes place, local bosses, they refer to him as a gangster, a pirate, a felon who threatened peace and stability of this growing city.
Yeah, that's a great point in the book that you also make. It's about he's building this really long list of enemies during this period. Could you describe what's happening and why that's significant both for him and also for the labor politics that are ongoing?
So in the aftermath of the 1906 strike, Gould is getting a longer and longer list of enemies, and he's certainly the subject of a campaign to eliminate him, as union activists so often are. But this also is a time in which employers, led by the very wealthy local lumbermen, are engaged in an open shop campaign. They go from one powerful union after another and defeat local unions in strikes. They refuse to deal with unions, and they, in the case of longshoremen, set up a non-union stevedore firm to compete with union workers. This is part of a national open shop campaign that really was dedicated to destroying the labor movement, and was very effective in many places, including in Grays Harbor. But locally in Aberdeen, what happens is that employers form their first of several citizens committees, this name used by employers for union busting operations. Later, citizens committees in Aberdeen with the same membership would engage in vigilante activities, violently attacking workers. This early citizens committee, though, operates mostly behind the scenes, targeting Gould. So they reach out to labor spies, first probably members of the Pinkerton agency, but later they turn to the big guns of labor spies, of private detectives that target workers. They go to the Thiel Detective Agency. And over throughout 1909, there are Thiel agents in Grays Harbor looking to create a case against Gould and starting to spread rumors about him as a murderer and him as a criminal. This is coinciding with what's going on in the press, where Gould is constantly being attacked as, again, a pirate and a thug and the head of a local criminal operation rather than a union. So Gould Ghoul is accused of, in the public eye, of murdering dozens, even more than 100 workers. But he's actually arrested on and charged with killing one person, his very good friend, a man named Charles Hadberg. Charles Hadberg was a sailor who lived with Billy Ghoul and who Ghoul worked with very closely in 1909, especially. So Ghoul is put on trial. He's arrested in February 1910. And he is put on trial later in the year, and he's convicted of committing one murder, this one, Charles Hadberg. He's convicted largely on the testimony of two men, labor spy from the Thiel Agency, who was hired to produce evidence against Ghoul and to remove him, as spies so often are. And then Ghoul's friend, another friend named John Klingenberg. Klingenberg was a very small, that does matter in this, Scandinavian immigrant who was a sailor. Klingenberg in late 1909, early 1910, takes off on a ship, sails to Mexico as a member of the Sailors Union. But when he's in Mexico, he tries to leave the ship. He is then drugged by the captain of the ship, kidnapped or shanghaied, depending on what term you want to use, brought back to Gray's Harbor, and then interrogated, likely tortured by private citizens, perhaps the perhaps members of the Thiel Agency, and told that he needs to testify against Ghoul. He does end up testifying against Ghoul, saying that he pulled the trigger to kill Hadberg. Klingenberg says he pulled the trigger. He's later also convicted of murder and sentenced to prison, at which point he says, somewhat famously or infamously, whatever, that the whole thing was a put-up job. Throughout this time period, there's another of Ghoul's friends who had disappeared named John Hoffman, a cigar dealer. His body was never located, and Ghoul was never put on trial or convicted of that. But once Ghoul is behind bars in February, what happens is just an amazing situation unfolding. These newspapers that had for so long seen Ghoul as the Ghoul of Gray's Harbor, that had accused him, at least privately, and often in print, of being a monster, they begin to tie him to every crime that has ever happened, almost, in Gray's Harbor history. They accuse him of arson, they accuse him of murdering dozens or more than 100 men. They accuse him of robbery and everything else imaginable. They blame him for this so-called floater fleet, collection of drowned men found in the Wishkaw and Chehalis rivers. What they don't mention, of course, is that a large percentage of those drowned men were members of his union, who he, of course, had really gone to the mat to protect and had done everything to protect them. And had actually risked his life to protect them and had gone to jail to protect them. So this story, I think, unfortunately, once it gets created in 1910, it just spreads like wildfire because there's not really much of a counter narrative. Ghoul's allies in the labor movement protect him. They testify. They even testify that the body that Ghoul is convicted of killing, that it didn't belong to Hadberg, and they refuse that person a union burial, even though he was supposedly, if it was Hadberg, he was a a member of the Sailors Union. And the historians out there, I suppose that's everybody listening or most, probably know about Chronicling America, the newspaper database that's so great. Fortunately or unfortunately, the Aberdeen Herald, really anti-labor newspaper from Gould's hometown that was published at this time period. It's entirely searchable. And so many true crime sleuths out there have just taken the story presented by Gould's enemies in the newspaper, this thinly sourced or entirely fabricated story, and written about it.
You know, it makes me wonder too, more broadly, about, you know, why is Gould's story so important for our understanding of how class works in the West?
Right. Yeah. So class and class conflict is really at the center of this book. I kind of went out of my way to make that clear in the introduction. And I think the story of Billy Gould and the story of this area is really, really doesn't make sense at all without thinking about the importance of class. And so there's, I think, two ways of looking at class in this history of Gould and Grays Harbor. The first is that class really framed Gould's experiences and the experiences of people throughout the American West and in other industrial capitalist societies. What I mean by this is that looking at Gould's life through the lens of class makes so much more sense than the usual true crime stories that so often portray the world as good versus bad people, or in the case of Gould, these crazy bad people just going around murdering people to satisfy their urges. So this story of Gould really follows that he's just a deviant who has to satisfy his urges to kill. And what's so tragic about that, although I think that's very characteristic of true crime popular writing, is that it fails to account for almost everything. It fails to account for his own words and the words of his coworkers. It fails to account for his life of union activism, his brave commitment to risk his life and freedom, advocating for other immigrant workers, of course, white immigrant workers. I want to really, at some point, I need to stress that he was no hero, no working class hero. He was a vicious racist and responsible for forming an organization in Grays Harbor, and was the first president of an Asian Exclusion League. But the history of Gould's world and life that I wrote places class at the center, and that takes seriously the historical context. It looks at the importance of violence against workers on the job and in the community that Gould very much fought. These were so often class conflicts. I think more specifically, in terms of discussing class, of course, its intersections with race, ethnicity, gender, and other identities really helps to make sense of the world that Gould lived in, and the experiences that he and other comrades faced. In the first place, they were migratory workers. As sailors and other migratory workers throughout the West faced, this was often a very violent life where employers often acted with impunity against them. In the case of sailors, would often flog them, would shanghai them, would imprison them. And that when workers tried to organize, they were so often arrested, jailed, thrown in prison, killed even. But also the importance of class in this story is really obvious when you think about the law. For example, in terms of voting, many of Gould's enemies in this book, in this story, are politicians. But at this time period before 1910, only a tiny percentage of people could vote. And thanks to so many good historians of suffrage and of disenfranchisement, we know that women and we know that people of color often couldn't vote. But it's also true at this time that very few workers could vote in many Western cities. Migratory workers had never established residency. They had no say in local politics. In Gould's time in Aberdeen, it was common for only about one in 30 residents to vote. This is the same with juries. We have this idea, this mythical idea of being tried by one's peers, but the jury that eventually convicts Gould of one act of murder was hardly his peers. It was drawn from a list of property-owning males. And then when he did go to jail, when he did go to prison, and in fact, anytime a historian will look through the police registry or the jail registry, what do you notice? Everybody, if occupations are listed, everybody or almost everybody is a worker of some sort. And when Gould gets to the Washington State Penitentiary, he could hardly have avoided sailors. There were dozens of sailors there, really disproportionate share of the prison population. This last week, I've spent some time at the Washington State Archives and just looking at police records, and so much of what the police do and what they were doing had to do with regulating the poor, protecting property, really criminalizing poverty, arresting people for being publicly drunk, and the like, and otherwise, of course, also sometimes attacking picketers. So class is really at the center of this story, and I think it helps to make so much more sense of what's going on.
You know, Aaron, this is such a great book, and I was just wondering, for people who are reading it, for our listeners right now, you know, what do you hope that they're going to take away from this book?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for asking that. So one of the takeaways is, and one that I haven't really focused on here, is that when talking about labor history, it's so important that we think about those on the other side of the class division, because labor historians were often very good at talking about workers and about working class activity, but employers are so good at acting collectively, you know, understanding their class interests and working to defend them. That's what we see in the case of this book. It's what we see in so many labor histories. And combined, employers have so much power to influence the police, the press, of course, workplaces which they own, the law and the courts. And very much related to this, that it's dangerous. It always has been dangerous. It's dangerous now. It was dangerous in Gould's time. And to organize working people, the dangers of organizing working people, advocating for working people, it's really difficult. Gould ended up going to prison, but how many of these labor activists in any strike end up going to jail or getting fired? Or in the case of Joe Hill, Sacco and Vanzetti, the Haymarket martyrs, Martin Luther King, in one way or another, have their lives ruined, even taken from them. When he was in the Washington State Penitentiary, Gould was surrounded by many members of the Radical Industrial Workers of the World Union, who had been convicted of criminal syndicalism, which outlawed membership in their organization. So Gould could have hardly noticed or hardly avoid noticing the class nature of the composition of the prisons. I guess the other piece of this, and this is probably fairly apparent, is that it's just very, I call this story that I've tried to deconstruct in this book, the myth of the Ghoul of Grays Harbor. And since this is the new books in the American West, I know many historians of the West focus on myths. But when we face myths that are so often really entrenched in what we think about the world, whether it's the myth of America as this land of freedom, et cetera, this myth of the Ghoul of Grays Harbor, it's really important to interrogate that and to think about who benefits and who doesn't benefit, who suffers because of that myth. The ghoul myth really is one of the founding myths of this town and of Grays Harbor, because the people who eventually convict him, who eventually get rid of him, they are often seen as these founding fathers of Grays Harbor, these benevolent people who came together to eliminate this criminal monster and make Grays Harbor safe for settlement. It is it's an important myth in this region's history.
Well, Aaron, this is such a great book, and I know it just came out, so I'm assuming you're going to be giving some talks, and because of COVID, those are likely going to be virtual. But do you have any sense of what you're going to be working on next? Do you have anything else in the mix right now? Not to put pressure on you for that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. I know this podcast will be on the internet forever, or whatever forever means. But this is, of course, this talk is going on during COVID, and so much of what historians do is exceptionally difficult right now. But I have taken some time to step back and think about next projects, and I do very much enjoy research and writing. The two projects that I'm working on right now, one is nearly done and one is, let's say, halfway there. The first is my dissertation to book project. I'm trying to convert my dissertation to a book, and it is a study of community-based radicalism and employer anti-radicalism, employer collective action against workers in Grays Harbor from about 1900 to 1940, because this area is the center of trade unionism during Gould's time, but it's also one of, if not the largest center of Wobbly activity all the way throughout the 1920s, and as well as a large center of socialist and communist activity. The second one, and I think this one has the potential to reach a wider audience, perhaps, but I've been working for some time on a biography of a man named Albert Johnson, a congressman from Washington, and a newspaper editor, actually from Hoquiam, which is Aberdeen's twin city or neighboring city. He's a editor at the time that Ghoul is arrested, and he actually suggests in an editorial that Ghoul should be lynched. But he then is elected to Congress in 1912 and serves until 1933. In many ways, he might be the most important person to come from Washington's coastal area. And I know that might sound strange because so few people have heard of him, but he is the head of the House of Representatives Immigration Committee in the 1920s. And the 1924 Immigration Act that puts all these racist quotas on immigration and, you know, bans Asian immigration into the country, it's called the Johnson-Reed Act. And so he is the leading immigrant restrictionist in Congress during the 1920s. And so I'm working on a biography of him that I think can really explain this period of nativism that's so prominent in the 1920s, and that gets expressed in lots of different ways, including with the Ku Klux Klan, but also with Johnson and the immigration laws. So,
yeah, those sound excellent. I do want to ask you one final question, though, and it's about writing. One of the things I've noticed that you've done here, and a few other authors I've spoken to as well have done, is reconstruct sort of working class biographies, ordinary people's lives. That's incredibly hard to do. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts or recommendations for people on how to do that, on how to reconstruct these social worlds of these working class people, and also what you've learned from that process in writing a biography like that.
Yeah, that's good. It's weird because I probably in class will talk about not liking biographies very much because they are so often, I think most social and labor historians would say, written about old dead white men. This constant stream of founding fathers books. I don't know. I don't read those. There is something fairly appealing about writing a biography in the case of Gould of a working class person, because they're so often written out of history, and we see them as just the nameless, faceless, crowds of history. And yet these are real people. These are real people who had lives, who did work, who had goals, who, had problems. And I think it can be really illuminating, really important to think about working people as actually having their lives matter rather than just being sort of the junk on the scrap heap of history. But also, biographies can be really good lenses into seeing these wider themes. I think people are much more willing to pick up a book that looks like a biography than they are perhaps a rather dense community study, for instance, or other types of history. And so I think that it's a nice way to take a chunk of time, in this case, a person's life, and to tell so much about society through that person's experiences. In terms of sources and sort of the pitfalls, I'm definitely experiencing the two sides of that, where in the case of Gould, the sources that exist are for his early life, almost non-existent, and then for his later life, written by his enemies to mock him and to tell the world that he's a criminal monster. And so I'm actually left in that case, just poring through every newspaper article over the course of about a decade, looking at all union records to see if he's mentioned. So really in that case with Gould, so much of it is, much of it was looking for a needle in a haystack and also using background sources to paint a picture of his life. The Albert Johnson Project is just the opposite, because a congressman in office for 20 years who published newspapers throughout his life and wrote constantly and was also his whole life middle class and rich. So there's sources all over the place. I have this maybe weird obsession with getting every possible source. And that's just going to be impossible for Johnson. But I think in his case, it'll be people want to read about immigration and racism and immigration restrictions, I think probably now as much as ever. And to see this long history of anti-immigrant activism, of nativism, and of politicians, just enormously popular politicians, writing the wave of anti-immigrant hysteria to the highest halls of power, then I think that's a story that needs to be told.
Yeah. Well, Aaron, thanks so much for joining us. We're excited to have you on. Your new book, The Port of Missing Men, is out now through University of Washington. And thanks so much. You have a great, this will come out after the new year. So I hope you had a great new year.
Thank you so much. It was really, really nice to talk to you, Ryan.
Yeah. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.